Maybe it's because people in the news business tend to be diggers themselves, but we like to hang out with archaeologists. Two in particular make such regular appearances here in the Exchange that we figured we'd have them on every month. Underground History is what we call our visits with Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA. They spent a good chunk of the summer digging on the Oregon coast. We have stories from them and from John Polly, assistant state archaeologist who has a big find in the Willamette Valley to talk about. Welcome, John.
Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. Chelsea Rose, of course, our regular, is a research faculty member at SULA, a historical archaeologist. Chelsea, good to have you back in the studio.
Hi, great to be here.
And Mark Tveskov is on the phone with us this time. He's professor of anthropology and is joining us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
So what is it you're doing in Washington?
Well, I had two reasons to be back here. SULA just received a grant from the National Park Service to continue our research on the Rogue River Indian Wars, and I was attending a workshop for that grant, and I was also doing some research in the National Archives on the Rogue River War.
I understand you came across a pretty good find in the National Archives in the way of a map.
Yeah, it's a 1852 map of the Rogue River that's never been published before, and it was drawn by Army officers reconnoitering a trail from the Oregon coast to Jacksonville during the Gold Rush.
And what were you looking for in there that maybe is not something you had in your hands before?
Well, details about it. I knew about the expedition, and we had a blurred photocopy of this map, but I had the actual original map in my hands, and you could see some notations on it and some other aspects of it that we didn't know about before.
All right, all kinds of cool stuff on there.
Yeah.
Chelsea Rose, the summer field work we talked to you about most recently, summer field school by Gold Beach, that has concluded now, right?
Yep, now we've got everything back in the lab, and as soon as the students get back with the start of the school year, we'll start cleaning everything and going through it and doing all the next phases, which is the long part.
Well, how much stuff do you bring back, and how long does it take to process it until you're sure of what it is that you're looking at?
Well, how much you bring back depends on how successful your dig is or what type of site you're working on, but we brought back more than expected, which is exciting. And this is the long, sometimes tedious part. For every 1 hour in the field, it's about 4+ hours in the lab. So, and it'll take us, you know, till the end of the year probably to get everything cleaned and beginning to be organized.
John Polly, you're on because you had a find of a biface site in the Willamette Valley. This is not a term you hear every day. What does that mean?
Well, we actually use the term biface cache,
mm-hmm.
and a cache is basically something that, you know, somebody put aside at a place with the hope that they would come back later to retrieve it at some point in the future. And obviously that never happened in this case, and it sat on this property for what we think is probably between 1,000 to 4,000 years. Before it was found by the landowner not that long ago.
So what is a biface, though?
A biface is it's a piece of stone that has been flint-napped on both sides. So it's been worked on both sides. Usually tools are made from the process of flint-napping.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also just work a cobble down at a quarry site to make it more transportable, and then, you know, your biface could then be used as a trade item, you know, or a commodity that could then be used to make other tools with.
So it's not quite a raw material, but something that's been intended to be turned into a tool. You can just choose what you're going to do with it once you get it in trade or purchase or whatever.
Correct.
Okay. How significant a find is this, either in location or in age?
Well, it's very significant, mostly because of the type of site it is. It's not that significant necessarily because of age. There are a lot older sites in the state of Oregon. But we don't ever see the trade bifaces that often as far as even being able to recognize them as such. If we found a biface just within an archaeological site, we may not know the whole story of how that biface came to, you know, be deposited in that site. But in the case of a cache, we now have a glimpse at what these items looked like when they were being traded, and that's significant. But it's also significant because it's the only known biface cache in the Willamette Valley, and I've been trying to find out how many biface caches have been recorded in the state of Oregon, and out of about 36,000 sites, I think I'm at about 28 so far, so there's not a lot of them to begin with.
Okay, so a really small number of those. I understand the landowner got a hold of you folks at the archaeological office. How rare is that?
It's not that rare for a landowner to get a hold of us. We do get emails and phone calls, and at times folks will just come in and want to show us something they found on their property. To be honest, sometimes the things that people show us are not artifacts, but, you know, you can kind of see why they might have thought that. But in this instance, I received an email from the landowner with 14 bifaces. It was a photo with 14 bifaces, and he asked if I had any interest in what he had found on his property.
It's safe to say there was some.
it was instantaneous, uh-huh. And I immediately reached out to him. We set up a time to meet in person the very next day, and probably a day or two after that, I was out at his property while he walked me around to show me where he found them and what he was doing. And it was at that time that we decided that if he was okay with an archaeological excavation occurring on his property, that I would see what I could do to put something together.
John Polly is the assistant state archaeologist for Oregon, and he's a part of our new underground history segment with our regulars Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. You can get into the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. How often, Chelsea and Mark, is it an issue to get access to lands that you suspect will hold some artifacts?
Well, quite often that is. I mean, in the West particularly, land issues are pretty common politically and economically, and oftentimes there's a perceived fear that disclosure of something like an archaeological site would lead to, impediments to your rights to your own land.
And what actually is the case, Chelsea? I mean, and how much psychology do you have to apply along with the anthropology?
Well, I think the big message here, and one of the things that's been so successful about John's work, is that, we're really interested because this is something that's everybody's history in Oregon, the history of the place that we all live. And some of these sites are protected, no matter if the land is private or publicly owned. But the goal is not to take away people's rights. It's to be able to retrieve the information from the find. And to get back to what John was, John's site, what's so cool about that, like he said, is not just these artifacts that are old and pretty neat, but the cache itself and being able to pinpoint the exact location, because that's human behavior. That's something someone did 4,000 years ago, maybe, and that's what's so interesting. And if you don't have access to the site to work with landowners, then we miss that critical part of that story.
After 1,000 to 4,000 years, I mean, how much stuff could possibly have built up above? I mean, how deep are we talking generally? I don't know if there is a regular passage of time versus, inches of dirt figure here.
There is none, because it's different no matter where you are. If you're in the desert, stuff that's 10,000 years could be on the surface. If you're in somewhere that floods or, landslide, different ways that soil accumulates over time, it could be 2 meters deep.
So, John Polly, what's the plan from this point? I mean, these are the Kalapuya people are believed to be the ones who left this biface cache behind?
Yes, it's in the traditional territory of the Santiam mm-hmm. band of the Kalapuya. And part of the process for me to research this place involved me going to the tribe's offices themselves to try and get information from them. So I've met in person with people at the Siletz Reservation and at the Grand Ronde Reservation, and I've spoken on the phone with folks from the Warm Springs Reservation.
Who did you get to help you with the dig?
I've received a lot of help from a lot of different people. I have a long laundry list here of folks, but basically, I just started asking people that I've worked with in the past, people I work with here at the State Historic Preservation Office, and people at nearby universities, wherever I could get them. But I had people come from as far away as La Grande and Tacoma, Washington, and the Dalles to help me out.
Wow. So all kinds of folks there helping out. Underground History is the name of the segment. John Pauley is Assistant State Archaeologist for Oregon. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov are regulars from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. You can get in this conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it seems like every time you want to open up the ground and look for things, Chelsea, you can probably relate to this, you get a fair number of people who want to take part.
Yeah, and we, you know, part of our mission at Sula is to do that public archaeology and the community archaeology, and that's always something we're thinking of, providing these opportunities. Sometimes there are safety issues or other issues that don't allow open access like that, but whenever we can invite people out either to help with the dig or to watch us when we're doing the dig to see what we're doing, or to share what we found in instances like this radio show, you know, we try to take advantage of that, because the more transparency we have and the more we make people feel a part of this process, which they have every right to, because a lot of this work is paid for with public monies, the more it's protected, the more everybody feels like we're on the same team in protecting these cultural resources.
Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking how one of the commonalities between John's project with this biface cache and our summer work is they were both, at least part of ours, was on private land, as was this. And rather than a conflict, it was an opportunity for people to feel engaged with the past. Down in Gold Beach, we had people come out of the woodwork who had been and who knew about that site and had thought about it and was part of, you know, who they felt they were in terms of their heritage. And it went from being a random place on the landscape to a place where the community was able to celebrate and think about the past. And the amount of attention this biface cache has gotten is another example of that. It's people are able to engage with their own history. And the transparency of the process, like Chelsea says, wasn't created that opportunity. It didn't hinder it just because it was on private property.
And Chelsea, how do you keep people motivated when they, you know, they're looking for, I don't know, they expect to find some ancient Grecian urn or something, and they're finding little chunks of stuff?
Well, that is often the issue. People come out and they hear, you know, especially I tend to get pretty animated, and then they see I'm looking at little pieces of broken glass, and there's like, wait a minute, what? But, you know, it's the story behind it, and again, it's that human connection. So anytime we can trace these sites back to the point where a human made a choice to get an artifact where we found it on the landscape, that's really exciting. And so it's part of our job to kind of educate people about how to learn that, and also, most importantly, to protect the sites so that we can make those connections. Because if the artifacts are removed from their find place, or if the sites are destroyed, we don't, you know, they are just pieces of broken glass, or, you know, you can't get at all those connections that can make something like a broken piece of glass in a specific spot on the landscape as important as a ruby statue.
So best if you find the ruby statue to leave it where it is, not pack it in bubble wrap and take it to the lab.
Yeah, like for example, with the site we did in Jacksonville, because we the Chinese Quarter site that we dug, we've spoken about that here. We excavated a house from 1888, and because it was all intact and we were able to scientifically take it out, a bottle from that site, we could not only place it on a map into the Chinese Quarter, but in a household on a specific shelf in the house. And so that level of detail is something that really helps you get at these deeper questions and more nuances into the human experience.
That's right. And an example with these bifaces, which seems like a fairly obscure thing, stone bifaces were actually one of the first stone tools invented by humans 2 million years ago. And this biface cache gives a link to human behaviors that's been going on for 2 million years all over the world. Bifaces are the basis for the majority of stone tools made by people, and their use in exchange was done by people in Europe and Asia, Africa, and Native America.
It sounds like something that was really basic to the culture, that you know, everybody had these available to give, or wanted them anyway.
Well, and if these were a cache for trade, you know, it's kind of like a store, and there's no store ledgers or records. So knowing where those were helps us get at, I'm assuming, John, you jump in here, trade routes, you know, different areas that were significant to these types of activities and connecting people together with the resources they need to be successful.
Absolutely, and one of the interesting things about obsidian is that we can source it. So that's a real benefit to archaeology in Oregon, because there is so much obsidian that we can identify where pieces such as these obsidian bifaces that I'm working with, where they originated, where the quarry was.
And these are specifically like 80 miles away or something, weren't they?
80 miles away as the crow flies to a source called Obsidian Cliffs.
Okay. I want to get to Mark before we get out of the hour. About tell us a little more about the grant from the Federal Battlefield Protection Program.
Well, as you know from our visits to your show, we've been working on these Rogue River war sites for a number of years, and we applied for and received a grant from the National Park Service, which is 100 years old this weekend, to continue that work. And we're going to be doing excavation at a couple more sites, but more importantly, we're going to be able to wrap up a lot of the research we've been doing and nominate a number of archaeological places to the National Register of Historic Places.
How many places do you think they'll be altogether? Do you have a rough
number?
At
least 8 archaeological sites, including the Fort Lane site, the Battle of Hungry Hill site, and some others that we've talked about on your show before.
And if they're accepted, what happens to them in terms of status? What can and can't be done with the land?
Well, what we're hoping and the goal of it is to raise their public profile, to make them stop being random places on the landscape that a few people know about that become part of the shared heritage for all of Oregon. And the state of Oregon can use this as a means to encourage tourism and interpretation and give tax incentives and things like that for preservation. In a way similar to like the Oregon Trail, which is another kind of National Register property with multiple individual places. We're hoping to raise the profile like that.
With the summer field work over, I can't imagine you're ever stopping field work completely, Chelsea. Is there a worse set of conditions you can ever remember working in? I mean, you can just imagine mud and heat and everything else.
Actually, Fort Lane was one of the worst because there's star thistle, which is really scratchy and itchy, and it was 103 one time when we were out there, and that was pretty miserable.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah,
so
the Oregon coast work this summer was a dream. It was the worst, the best scenario.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, nice light winds and cooler temperatures and the whole shebang. Well, all kinds of great stuff happening in archaeology, so we're glad to be kicking off this segment, Underground History, which we hope to bring to the audience monthly. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov are from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. John Polly, the Assistant State Archaeologist, thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having us.
Sure.